I'm John Polkinghorne, and I have a quite long career as a theoretical physicist. I was a professor in Cambridge, and I enjoyed that very much. But after 25 years, I felt I'd done my little bit for physics, and the time had come to do something else. Because Christianity has always been central to my life, I got ordained and went into parish life for a bit, and then came back to the academic world to write and think about how science and religion relate to each other. So I've had an interesting and varied life.
So why have you written this book now, and what are you setting out to do with it?
Well, the book has arisen out of a website that Nicholas Beale has run about me for about 10 years, which is an interactive site. And people ask questions, and Nick and I seek to produce answers to them. And our purpose is to show people that there are motivations for religious belief. Religious belief isn't just a question of shutting your eyes and believing impossible things because some unquestionable authority tells you. There are reasons for it, and we want to share our reasons with the people who inquire. And we thought after doing this for 10 years, we could make an interesting book out of some of the most leading questions.
Now, you were a quantum physicist, and one thing that struck me that quantum physics and religion have in common is a taste for seemingly crazy ideas. In quantum theory, you can have particles can be in two places at once and even appear out of nowhere. And in religion, you can have these sort of all-knowing, invisible super beings. I mean, do you see there as being common ground between them? Do you think these ideas appeal to similar mindsets?
Well, I think if physics teaches you anything, it teaches you the world is surprising. As you say, things can be both here and there, which sounds ridiculous. So therefore, we are prepared to realize that the world is different from the way common sense sees it. So the natural question for a physicist to ask, either in science or in fact religion, is not, is it reasonable? As if you knew beforehand the shape the reason had to take. It isn't reasonable. Something should be both here and there. But we ask a different question, in one sense more open, in another sense more demanding. What makes you think that might be the case? In other words, what you are going to suggest to us may be very surprising and strange and unexpected, but we won't believe it unless you have motivating evidence for it. And I'm quite prepared to, in fact, welcome approaching my religious beliefs in that same spirit as I approach my scientific beliefs.
Well, this is something I was going to go on to next, really. I mean, in the scientific view of the world, at the very least, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But in religion, it kind of demands belief in some quite outlandish ideas in the absence of any proof. And how do you square that as a former scientist? Does your scientific mind not have to take a back seat?
Not at all. I certainly don't switch my mind off when I think about religion. I object to the word outlandish. They may be strange and surprising. But that's a different matter. There are motivations of those beliefs. I mean, there are two sorts of motivations, really. One is just the nature of the world. Science finds a world that is wonderfully ordered, amazingly fruitful, a ball of energy is turned into the home of saints and scientists. Are these all things just happy accidents, or are they the sign that a deeper mind and a deeper purpose lies behind what's going on in the world, and belief in God answers those questions positively? And then, of course, I'm a Christian, and so my Christian beliefs center really on my encounter with the figure of Jesus Christ, as I believe I meet him in the New Testament, in the church, and in fact in the sacraments. So there's motivating evidence. We don't talk about proof, actually, either in science or in religion. We talk about well-motivated beliefs. We commit ourselves to them, but we know that we don't know everything about everything that we would like to know.
One of the central beliefs of Christianity is that God became man. How do you think that happened?
Well, I'm not sure I can explain how it happened, but I certainly believe that it happened. You're right, at the center of Christianity lies an extraordinarily exciting and mysterious, and I believe true idea, that the God who is invisible and mysterious and hard to think about has acted to make God's nature known, in fact, in the clearest and most accessible way, by living a human life, experiencing a human death, and I believe also in the resurrection triumph over death in Jesus Christ. And so if I want to know what God's like, and it's very hard to think about God, I have to look at Christ. I say, does God care for people? Well, did Jesus care for people? The answer is obviously yes. And I believe that reflects the divine nature that was present in him.
Why do you believe, though, that God became man? I can see how it happened, but why do you believe that happened?
Well, I can't give you a completely adequate answer in a couple of sentences, obviously. I think I'd start with saying what's special about Jesus, and I think one of the things that's special about him is I believe he was raised from the dead the first Easter day. You see, there's something strange about Jesus compared with other great religious leaders. Of course, he says wise things and is credited with remarkable deeds, as they are too. But he seems he dies in midlife, deserted by his friends, a painful and a shameful death. My God, why have you forsaken me? While the others die in honored old age, surrounded by their disciples. I believe that that first Good Friday was the end of Jesus' life and story. We would never have heard of him. It would just have been a failure. So something continued the message of Jesus and the life of Jesus. And as I look at the New Testament evidence of that, and I have to look at it carefully and scrupulously, and it would take a while to go through it all, I believe that he was indeed, strange and unexpected as it may seem, raised from the dead the first Easter day. And if that's the case, there's something very special and particular about him of quite unique significance. And then you have to explore what that might be. And doing all that carefully, and I believe scrupulously, I mean, truth is the issue here, not anything else, I reached the conclusion that he was indeed God living a human life in first century Palestine.
For an awful lot of people, for religion to work as an outlook on life and as a philosophy doesn't require any proof of God's existence. Does it matter if God is real?
Oh, I think it matters tremendously. I mean, I think the question of truth is absolutely as fundamental to religion as it is to science. I mean, religion might seem to be able to do all sorts of things for you, strengthen you in life, console you in the approach of death or whatever, but it can't really actually do these things unless it's actually true. So I think the question of truth is absolutely fundamental, and that's why we've called our book Questions of Truth. That's what we're trying to address.
I was interested in your take on why God is invisible. You say in your book, the presence of God is veiled because when you think about it, the naked presence of divinity would overwhelm finite creatures, presumably meaning us, depriving them of the possibility of truly being themselves.
Yes.
Do you honestly believe that? Is it saying that it would be too much for us?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, if you think of a finite being suddenly finding himself, herself in the presence of absolute infinite being, we would sort of shrivel up. And God is not a sort of cosmic tyrant trying to whip us into shape. God wishes to draw us into the divine life, in fact, but to draw us through love and not through coercion. And therefore, I believe that at this stage anyway of the creation, God's presence is necessarily to a significant degree veiled from us, just to give us the chance, the room, the space in which to be ourselves, to make ourselves, and to make decisions for or against the love of God.
So, I mean, if seeing God would be so negative for us, I mean, should we stop sending up space telescopes and using machines like the LHC to probe, like, the nature of the vacuum and search for extra dimensions? Or do you think we'll never find him wherever we look?
Well, we certainly won't find God by space exploration or even by the LHC. We might see signs and hints of God's mind and behind the order of the world. In fact, I think we do. But, I mean, God is not to be found in that sort of way. God is to be found through personal encounter, an encounter that involves not only a critical assessment, but also awe and obedience and a willingness to accept and act upon the truth that's made clear to one. It's a much more complicated issue than could be decided by clever scientific apparatus.
What do you think will happen to you when you die?
Well, I believe that death is a real thing. But I don't think it is the ultimate end, because I think only God is ultimate. I think I shall have a destiny beyond death. It's obviously hard to imagine in detail. Wait and see is the best answer to that question in one sense. But I think that in the world to come, God will be progressively unveiled, and we'll be drawn more and more into the divine reality, and our lives will be transformed. And heaven is going to be interesting. It isn't sitting on a cloud, strumming a harp and shouting hallelujah all the time. It will be the endless exploration of the inexhaustible riches of the divine nature. So I think it's a remarkable destiny that lies ahead of us.
But you think your body will decompose?
Oh, of course my body will decompose. And so, but I also think it's intrinsic to human beings that we do have a body. And that's why I very much accept the Christian hope of resurrection. It isn't a sort of spiritual survival, a sort of ghostly bit of me floating along. We're not apprentice angels. We're embodied beings. Our bodies will die and so on, but God will not allow us, the real me, to be forgotten. And God will, I believe, in an unimaginable but true act of resurrection, re-embody me in a new form of matter, so to speak, in quotation marks, which will be different from the matter of this world, the matter of this world is endowed with futility because it's a world of evolving process, and in evolution, the death of one generation is the necessary cost of the new life of the next. But the world to come will be different from that because we'll be a different stage in God's creative purposes.
Are you saying you think your consciousness will be immortal? Do you think, or do you think your brain will decompose and your consciousness will disappear as that happens?
Well, I think that if I am to be truly a conscious human being, I need a brain of some sort, not necessarily a brain made of the matter of this world. So I believe that my consciousness has its own natural immortality, but I believe that God will not allow that real me, that conscious being with all the memories and character and relationships which are formed in this life, simply to disappear. God will hold that pattern, that's me, if you like, in the divine memory, and then God will re-embody that pattern in God's great final act of resurrection. It's a strange, mysterious belief, but it's, to me, it has the sort of complexity and integrity that one would expect of a true belief.
John, just finally, what do you? What's your view on the debate which sort of seems to come and go about the teaching of creationism or maybe more accurately sort of intelligent design on the science curriculum?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the science curriculum ought to teach Darwinian evolution. I mean, it may not be the total explanation of the history of life, but it is a very, very important part of the of understanding the diversity of living beings. And that's what science is about, and widely accepted and well-supported scientific theories are what should be taught in the scientific classroom. Outside the scientific classroom, in religious studies periods or whatever it may be, it is perfectly legitimate to explore other ways of understanding this, deeper ways of understanding it. Is there something going on in what is happening, so to speak, which is a religious question. As far as intelligent design is concerned, I think they make two mistakes. They make a scientific mistake. They haven't proved the irreducible complexity of these little molecular engines that they talk about. But more importantly, they make a theological mistake. Because behind it, they don't say this, but it's clear that behind it is the idea that if nature did it, somehow God didn't have a hand in it. And that's absurd to me. I believe that God is the creator, the ordainer, and sustainer of nature. And God acts as much through natural processes as in any other way. So I have no difficulty whatsoever in holding together a firm scientific belief in the evolutionary process and also my Christian faith.
Do you think religion is under fire from science, or do you think that's a fairly sort of minority, sort of Dawkins-led minority? And do you think religion is going to be carry on for the next century? Do you think it's going to be here in 100 years' time?
Oh, I certainly think so, because I think God's going to be here in 100 years' time. I think religion is a reaction to that. At the moment, there is, a small minority of very polemical, very high-profile, very strident scientific atheists who are catching a lot of headlines. I think they're not typical of the scientific community, not typical, indeed, of the non-believing scientific community, many of whom are, I think, more calm and more respectful, if wary, of the insights of religion. So I think that Dawkins and co. are a pretty exceptional crowd, actually, and not typical of the scientific attitude to religion.